This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and sometimes women right there in your midst who have done incredible things for the sake of our freedom. Each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from members of our greatest generation, we want to honor them for their service and their sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't lose sight of the price that's been paid for our freedom. Along the way, we're educated, we're entertained, and oftentimes inspired. And I'm pretty sure that'll be the case today. Inspiration is perhaps the biggest thing that millions around the globe have drawn from the incredible story of Louis Zamperini, who died last week at the age of 97. If you've read the best-selling book Unbroken, you know that name, Zamperini. In December, Unbroken the movie from Universal Pictures and director Angelina Jolie will be hitting theaters. You can read up on it at unbrokenfilm.com, and I have it linked at hometownheroesradio.com. And speaking of Universal, I'm excited about an opportunity for you to win a family four-pack of tickets to Universal Studios Hollywood by sharing what Lucky Louie's story means to you. I'm going to tell you more about that later in the show, but let's talk about Louis Zamperini. Track star, World War II bombardier turned prisoner of war, believed dead, but he survived. He forgave the men who tortured him and spread his message of forgiveness, of perseverance, of hope until the day he died. I had the privilege of interviewing him on Hometown Heroes in 2011, just after his 94th birthday. He was as sharp and quick-witted as a man half that age. And we'll jump into that conversation now with his explanation of how early on in life he earned that nickname, Lucky Louie.
I just moved into Long Beach from Olean, New York, from the cold climate to the warm climate, and a kid challenged me to a race. And he beat me, and he ran across the street and was hit by a car and mangled. And so that was my first loss. Then I had another race a couple of years later in Torrance when we moved there, and this kid challenged me to a race across the street, and I lost that one, and he was hit by a car. So, you know, I was lucky I wasn't fast.
Yeah, I guess that's a situation where it's good not to be the fastest. But soon you would be the fastest. They started calling you Zamp the Champ around Southern California. You ended up at USC, and in 1936, you made the U.S. Olympic team.
Well, first of all, to make the Olympics, I'm running against the world's record holder in the 5,000 meters and the 2 mile. We came in a dead heat, so that was a big thrill. That put me on the team. And, of course, during the Depression, we used to forage for food. We were so hungry, and there was no unemployment was bad. But I got aboard a ship, and I'm stunned. I can't believe the food they kept bringing to the table. I mean, they just kept bringing stuff, and I just... So my gold medal was seeing how much I could eat before I got to Berlin. I gained 14 pounds, and that was too much.
14 pounds on one little cruise across the Atlantic.
Yeah, and then when I got to Berlin, I thought, I'm going to work it off. But then they have this beautiful village. They had a semicircle, two-story building, and each door was a door to every nation's cuisine. And so I had to try them all.
Well, of course.
Yeah, of course. Anyway, so I couldn't keep up the pace in the 5,000 meters, so I'm way behind, 50 yards behind the leading pack. I'm in the second pack of guys, but in the last lap, I thought, oh, man. But my brother always told me, he said, he was a coach, he said, everybody's tired the third lap of the mile. Think of it this way, just open up and run your guts out, because isn't 1 minute of pain worth a lifetime of glory? So I sprinted the whole last lap, and of course it brought the grandstand up to see a runner gaining 50 yards on the leader.
Mm-hmm.
And I came down the home stretch with the first pack, but I only got eighth place. But then it was in the papers that I ran the last lap in a blistering 56 seconds, which is unheard of. And then as a result of that, I got Goebbels, I guess it was, came over from the... The officers, German officers, were between Hitler and the American team.
Right.
And he said, Hitler wants to see you. I said, hey, I didn't win a gold. He said, well, he wants to see you. I went over, and he just said, the boy with the fast finish, a late handshake, and that was it. I guess it was exciting to see someone gain 50 yards, even though I didn't win anything.
Well, it sounds exciting to me, and if I had been announcing that race, I think I would have been going crazy watching you sprint past him.
And by the way, Jesse Owens and Mac Robinson, they were my roommates in the village. Great guys, both of them, and Jesse Owens especially, he was a prince.
With the story of Jesse Owens and that Olympics and the snub by Adolf Hitler, was that something that you were aware of that had an impact
well,
on you at
Jesse
the time?
Well, Jesse Owens was, as I say, people loved Jesse Owens, even though they never met him, because nothing got him down. If people made a racial remark, he'd just say, hey, it's not my problem, it's their problem. When Hitler came in the stadium, they were, by orders, they had to stand up and cheer him. But when Jesse Owens came in, he got twice the ovation that Hitler got. And because of that, I think Hitler hated blacks, and especially Jesse Owens.
Well, I certainly understand that. I guess you ran that last lap at about Jesse Owens' sprint speed, too.
Yeah, I wish.
Obviously, no one at that point, certainly from the West, had any idea of how evil Hitler really was and the things that he had planned, the things that he would carry out. What was your sense at the time of meeting this dictator?
Well, because the entire nation was military, we knew something was going on, and we figured he'd probably take over some country in Europe, and his plans were to take over the world. And I think we waited too long. Nobody wants to get involved, you know, the money and a war. It's always too late. Then you have to get involved, and then you got a real problem. Same thing happened with Japan. They were building an empire across the Pacific. Everybody knew, every school kid was taught in his history class that they're moving fast all over east, and they've already come as far as the Marshall and Gilbert Islands. What's their next island? The next island would be Hawaii. And about 7 months before Hawaii was hit, they put out a bombing notice in four languages, which we brought back copies of that, warning people what to do in case of a bombing attack. Well, who else could bomb Hawaii but Japan?
Makes
Nobody
sense
else.
To me.
So it's kind of a ridiculous thing, and people got suspicious that the people in high office knew something, and they didn't let the public know.
There are a lot of elements of your story, Louis, that are really incredible and hard to believe, but this one's right up there with them. You got a very unique souvenir after you were done running in Berlin. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, they had what they call beer automats, and the smallest beer they served in Germany was about a liter. You know? So we put down a couple of beers, and walking down the street, and I was standing in front of the chancellery, and I thought, what a beautiful building with these groins and pillars. And then I noticed all the beautiful flags flying from the top of the building. Those were long satin-like flags. You could never get near them. But then I saw a smaller flag down on the front wall, and I saw the guards walking back and forth. I timed them, and I had plenty of time to get across the street, get that flag, and get away. But when I got there, the flag was higher than I had anticipated. And then the guards did reach the corner. When they turned around and saw me, they began to scream in German, and I knew they were mad. But I jumped up, clutched the flag in my hand, and ripped it from the pole. And then I did what I do best, and that's run. And then I heard a crack like a rifle shot, and the word halt was saying. Well, I didn't need an interpreter for that. And so I halted, and they came up, and they spun me around rather rudely until they saw the American and Olympic flag on my coat pocket. And then they start talking to each other. The one officer who spoke very poor English, but I could understand him, he said, but why did you tear down the swastika, you know? And I said, well, I just wanted to take it home to America with me to always remind me of the wonderful time I had in your country. Well, he couldn't refuse, so he went inside. Evidently, he talked to von Fritz, because I remember when he came out, I remember the word Fritz.
Mm-hmm.
And he was told to let me have the flag, so I still have it.
You still have that flag?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been, people come in and photograph it all the time, and it's been on a lot of TV shows. I trained not for Berlin. I was aiming for the 1940 Tokyo Olympics. Well, of course, we were all in great shape. All the Olympians were looking forward to that Olympics in Japan. And then it was canceled because Japan was at war all over the East. And then Norway was supposed to pick it up, but then the war in Europe, they couldn't do that. It was a heartbreaker. It was pretty hard to take when you train 4 years for one event. But then when Pearl Harbor was hit, it was a different story. Everybody forgot, and the athletes forgot about being athletes. They wanted to get in to get it over with as soon as possible. And so most guys that I know of just volunteered. We didn't wait for a draft, and I ended up in the Air Corps.
And you would end up on a B-24 crew?
Yeah, we were up in Oneida, Winnetka, Washington, waiting for our plane to come in, and we were hoping for B-17s because the B-24 was known at that time as the flying coffin. Then in comes all these B-24s, and our hearts just sunk. And, of course, if you read the book, Unbroken, you'll realize how many B-24s more were lost in training than combat.
And the B-24, another nickname it has, the flying anvil. I don't know what's more intimidating, the flying anvil or the flying coffin.
The plane is, it did the job. It carried twice the bomb load of the B-17, and it was about 30 miles an hour faster. So in the Pacific, they brought back all the B-17s because they couldn't fly to these far-off islands. And so we all had B-24s. Now, we took 26 of these B-24s and flew from Midway to Wake Island, bombed it, and flew back. And no plane in the world could do that at that time but a B-24. And then our missions were like, we'd have to fly like 1 or 2 days to our mission. In Europe, they'd get to the target in an hour or two.
That first mission that you had, or I guess not the first mission, you talked about bombing Wake Island. But I understand there was a mission not too long later where your B-24 got shot up pretty good.
Yeah, this was the Nauru raid. Now, this was the greatest concentration of nitrate in the world, bird droppings over millions of years. And the Japanese needed that for fertilizer and making bombs. And so they had it well fortified. We sent 26 bombers over, and we were in the lead group. Our job is to knock out the attack and stuff like that.
Right.
But by going over first, we got the worst of it. And my final bomb hit their supply depot, which smoke shot in the air about 8,000 feet. And all their fuel was burned up. And because of that, I think out of 9 Zeros that took off, 3 of them attacked us and wouldn't let us go. And I think the reason they were so persistently after us is because they knew that our bombs blew up their fuel supply. And so we had a running battle for several minutes, and the Japanese Zeros came in so close they couldn't miss us. And also, they were in so close we couldn't miss them. So we finally shot down all 3 Zeros, but not before taking on 5 cannon holes in the plane.
Oof.
Right tail shot off. A hydraulic tank was blasted, so we had no power for the flaps and everything else. We had to use a crank and crank them down. And we had 7 guys laid out, 1 died. But the 4 officers, the navigator, pilot, co-pilot, myself, we were untouched. But I pulled 1 guy off of the catwalk. Now, the bomb bay doors wouldn't close because the hydraulic tank was blowing up.
Right.
And so I walked back there, and I found the radio man on the catwalk, which is about 14 inches wide, and he was just laying there with 1 leg hanging out, 8,000 feet above the ocean.
Ooh.
And he just looked up at me, and I pulled him back up on the flight deck, and I'm underneath the upper turret now. His foot was level with my head. I gave Brooks a shot of morphine, and then he was trying to say something. I couldn't understand, and I bent over. Just as I bent over to listen to him, I heard a loud crack, and a 20-millimeter went through the radio compartment and shattered the upper turret gunner's leg and foot.
Oh.
But if I hadn't bent over, it would have hit me right in the head.
Wow.
So that was really, when I think about it, I just bent over to listen to him, and the blast went right where my head was and hit Pillsbury in the foot and his leg.
Talk about a close call. Holy moly.
My service in Pacific was one close call after another.
It sure sounds like it. And what amazes me about that mission, you came down in that B-24, and you're the bombardier, and you're explaining what you did to try to help your crewmate there. You guys actually landed that plane with 600 bullet holes in it?
Well, what happened, they had a submarine, I believe it was called the Drum, 20 miles on course towards our island. But with a running battle with those 3 Zeros, we passed that point. We're supposed to land on the water, and the submarine will pick us up. But we're way past that point, and now the 4 motors are humming pretty good, so we... But the rest of the plane was a mess. But we had it, so we decided to take a chance and get it back to Funafuti. The plane was so badly shot up, the pilot and co-pilot had both their hands and their knees on the yoke or the steering wheel to keep the plane from stalling because of all the damage. And we had 600 fragmentation of bullet holes in the plane, plus five cannon holes. And we got back, and the plane kept porpoising. So we had to come in low and hot. This was a short runway, and you go right off the end of the runway, and we had no brakes. And so I had two parachutes tied to the waist, one in each window, and when we landed, I was going to deploy those chutes and stop the plane. And I guess that's the first time it was ever supposed to be tried. But later, somebody else did it, and it does work. And then they use that for space shuttle and all that stuff. But anyway, we got back, and we came in low and hot. And when we hit the runway, I thought, man, we're going to go off the end. But just as we touched down, the plane ground looped to the left. Well, what happened, one of those 20-millimeter shells had gone through the front of the airplane into the wing between the number one and number two motor, and actually penetrated the tire. So thank God the tire was flat because it caused us to ground loop. And now we're ground loop off of the runway with four motors going, and there's a bomber coming towards us with four motors going. This is really weird. And then the co-pilot knew we had no brakes, but he inadvertently pushed the brakes, and there was enough fluid in the brake well to cause it to lock momentarily, and that caused us to ground loop to the right. And so if he hadn't done that, we'd have gone straight into the other bomber, and both planes would have blown up.
Sure sounds like somebody was looking out for you that day.
That's what somebody said. You know, somebody up there loves you. I said, well, I'm glad somebody does.
And the world has come to love Louis Zamperini, a hero to so many. We lost him July 2nd at the age of 97, but his story will continue to inspire, especially after the film version of Unbroken hits theaters at Christmas time. More of Louis' story in his own words when Hometown Heroes continues after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.